This is Gary Wakefield, and you're listening to Queer Life Stories. Our podcast is recorded in La Truita, home of the Palawa people. We acknowledge the traditional owners of country, their diversity, histories and knowledge, and their continuing connections to land and community. We also acknowledge LGBTIQA+ advocates, friends and allies whose courage and strengths have helped to make this a more just society for lesbian, gay, bisexual, gender diverse and intersex populations and their families. This week's episode contains mentions of sexual violence.
Well, my name's Mike, or my friends call me Mike. I also go by the name Brady Michaels. That's kind of my name as an artist, as a photographer. I've kind of chosen that nom de plume as a way to kind of maybe protect myself a little bit, just because of the nature of the kind of stories that I tell. Call me Mike. That's what my friends call me, and I consider all members of the LGBT plus community my friends, my colleagues, my allies, my buddies, and so call me Mike. Kind of, in some ways I steer away from feeling the need to identify, but I'm a gay man. That's how I currently identify, but I'm kind of leaning more towards, I guess, the non-binary, but certainly or genderqueer, I think, and queer, as your previous podcast guest described so eloquently, is kind of just a simpler, easier way to, I think, to self-identify, but also for our straight allies as well. I think it's a nice umbrella term, and it is that nice reclamation of a term that, certainly from my experience growing up, queer was not a positive term. It was used against people, I guess, that were considered, not normal or not, not conforming to traditional gender norms. So, yeah, queer is, I think the easiest way for me as well, and it's kind of got that cultural connection as well in terms of popular culture and, even queer studies and things like that that I kind of delve quite deeply into with my work. So I was born in Queensland in 1975, but we moved quite very early in my life to Tasmania, which is where my mum is from. So her family, my family, is from the Huon Valley, a little town, Geeston, you might know it. And, so we moved there when I was about 6 months old. So my mum and dad had been kind of travelling up and down Queensland. My dad was a kind of bit of a jack of all trades, cane cutter, I think primarily was kind of the thing that they were, I guess they were kind of on the road, living in caravan parks in various towns throughout Queensland. And, but when I was born, I'm the third of three children. They moved down, bought a kind of a hobby farm just in Geeston, on up the 4 foot, as the locals like to call it, 4 foot road. And, so really all of my memories are based in Tasmania. Mm-hmm. And, so we lived there until I was about six. That's around the time my parents separated. So, and, I stayed with mum. That was kind of I was very young, but it was a no-brainer for me. I was much more, drawn towards her. And, my siblings, my brother went, my dad moved up to Queensland, so that was kind of, quite a big distance then, and that kind of shaped our relationship, down the track. Eventually both my brother and my sister ended up moving up to live with dad and my stepmother up in Queensland, and, I stayed down in Tassie with mum. They would have separated when I was like five or six, and I was six when we moved. So we were living in Geeston on the farm, and then once they separated, our mum had a fairly short-term relationship with a not very pleasant fellow in Geeston, and then that ended. And then, I think it was about halfway through grade one is when we moved to Hobart. So moved pretty much right to the middle of the town on Davies Street, and went to Albura Primary School, which was a great little school. Loved it there. I still say that that was like the most popular I ever was at Albura Street. So I was there for half of grade one and all of grade two and, loved it. Loved living in town, you know. I'd always, I think, aspired to live in bigger places and, I kind of tell the story about a particular sign on Davies Street for the Kevin Corby Chemist. It was a neon sign. I'm a science photographer now, so this is the kind of the throwback. I remember, I was driving into Hobart one night, I don't know what for, to go to the movies or something, and seeing this neon flashing sign. It was like, it was like I'd arrived in Manhattan, big smoke. And I was like, this is where I need to be, even from that very, very young age. I think I just naturally gravitated towards cities as opposed to being a country kid. I didn't really like my experience of the country, like the farm kind of life was nice, but school was not easy. I really hated school down there and kind of, really resisted that and starting to get picked on. And so moving to town was just like a fresh start that this little six-year-old needed. So our move to Hobart was a really good start, And then kind of, I guess things changed a bit after that. My mum met my stepfather and that was kind of the beginning of a very different life path for young Mike. So that was kind of the beginning of an abuse relationship that kind of went on for the next 3 to 4 years. It was a grooming scenario. So at the start it felt very nice and I was felt very loved and nurtured and hadn't really had a father figure as such, well, certainly in my own memory bank. So it was all kind of wonderful until I realized it wasn't, and that took a couple of years until that kind of realization came upon me. So it was what you know, basically. I guess in that kind of scenario you are drawn into a kind of a web of deception, I guess. You feel very safe and nurtured and loved, and it's not all bad because you're learning and you're being treated a certain way, which feels kind of nice at the time in terms of the way you're spoken to and feeling very loved. But I guess I was obviously very young, very naive, and didn't realize really until grade 4 or 5 that, that something wasn't right, Maybe I suspected or thought it was unusual. Certainly you're fed a story that this is something very special, a very special relationship, but a very private relationship. So I think an abuser's greatest fear is that you'll dob on them, you'll reveal to somebody. It might just slip out, or you could tell somebody purposefully because, you realize that what's going on isn't normal or isn't right. And for me, my realization was, watching an episode of, it was either like Four Corners or 60 Minutes, just happened to be on my own in the lounge room one night, and on came this story about child sexual abuse, and my world completely turned upside down at that point. That was when I knew, yes, this is wrong. It's not only wrong, it's illegal. I think there was a lot of, there seemed to be a lot of kind of focus on that kind of in reflection all throughout the 80s, kind of a focus on that as an issue, particularly in the private realm. I think later it's kind of come out more in institutional situations, with had Royal Commission here in Tasmania where people are able to share those stories. I think private abuse is a different kind of situation. There isn't a Royal Commission for that. There are only our own opportunities to tell our story, which is kind of partly why I'm here today.
So once you had that realization of watching 60 Minutes, what did you do with that realization?
Well, I started kind of emotional eating. I was not dealing with it very well. Obviously it was continuing on. I was still kind of caught in that trap. I didn't really know how to get out of it. And I guess there's always that manipulation. And at the end of the day, it's the emotional manipulation, certainly in my case, that kind of caused the most damage because, you know, suddenly I was just really confused. Why is he saying he loves me, but this thing's still going on? And, you know, he also had a drinking problem, so he wasn't always loving. Sometimes he was quite hateful. That was generally in front of other people, like in front of other members of the family. So there was still this, yeah, I guess that weight of carrying a secret and being so young, like it's such a big secret to carry on your little shoulders. Yeah. But, you know, I did eventually put a stop to it, you know, and this is a story I really haven't told very much, but I'm very kind of proud to tell because I think by so that was around year five, did start, you know, eating a lot, putting a lot of weight, guess becoming depressed in the way that a child gets depressed, you know, not really knowing what's going on but just kind of not coping. I did go from being a very, very well-groomed, like, you know, I was very confident up until a point until I realised what was going on wasn't right. So I was a very self-confident little fellow and immaculate presentation at all times, teacher's pet, excelling at everything I put my effort into at school, yeah, until then. So then I just became like an overweight, dishevelled, insecure boy that didn't really know what to do with this, you know, mess that he was in. But by kind of 1986, my stepfather decided we were going to move to Melbourne. So that was kind of a change at least. And by that point, my mother and my stepfather had moved to Melbourne kind of at the end of 85 and to set up, you know, set up a home and get things sorted. So I stayed with my grandmother for a while. I think it must have been during that period over that summer holidays where I must have processed it in a way that I knew that it had to stop and that I had to do something about it and that I had some power in the relationship. I think I realised that I could dob on him, I could expose him, you know, in whatever way that I could find, which would probably be just kind of breaking down and telling my mum or something like that. But I actually chose to do it in quite a strategic way. Not that I planned it, but I think by the time I moved to Melbourne in early 86, he hadn't really set up much of a home. We were living in a caravan park on the outskirts of Melbourne. And yeah, one night I just said no, and that was it. And he vanished from our lives almost immediately. So he knew that I knew that it was wrong and that he could no longer have that control over me. So that was my little empowering moment as a young kid, you know, and I do reflect back on that now and just go, oh, go little Mike. What a good thing to do. I knew that I had some power in that relationship and, you know, and that's, I guess, that's where secrets, they can be incredibly powerful and controlling, but they can be broken just like that. And I was smart enough to know that I could do that and I had no idea what the consequences would be. So we were kind of in that caravan park, well, apparently temporarily until we found some better accommodation in Melbourne. But, yeah, he vanished. He'd already started, I think, abusing another child, had hooked up with somebody else, another mother. So, yeah, probably my most poignant memory apart from that time I kind of put a stop to it was, you know, we're in the back of new car that he'd bought and there were a pair of children's shoes in the back of the car and I knew that he knew that I was no longer an option and maybe that's why he moved to Melbourne in the first place. Pedophiles are pretty smart at getting what they want, particularly back in those days. No internet, no dark web, no, you know, they had to do things physically, like move to another place and, yeah, so I just – that was kind of my parting memory of him was that and just going, oh, you know, and then that became, I guess, something that I carried with me, particularly I think as I got older, knowing that the behaviour was continuing even though it wasn't happening to me anymore and there's nothing I could really do about it. Was there, you know, that's kind of, I guess, a question that still lives with me now. I don't know if he's dead or alive, but, you know, there was never any kind of, you know, no proceedings against him. I never went to the police. I just kind of carried on with life carrying that experience and, yeah, just trying to process it in my own way. And, look, to be honest, went a bit batshit crazy for a few years. You know, I was pretty all over the place, very unstable. We were left in the caravan park, which we remained in for another year or so. That was another experience. I could definitely write a book about I think it was 1 to 2 years we were in that caravan park, the characters, the drug addicts, the other pedophiles, because pedophiles often seem to live in caravan parks where there's kids around. Mm. It was just this, oh, my God, microcosm of all these things that were kind of wrong with the world in one place. But, you know, they're also wonderful people, and we, I guess, being there, just me and my mum, not knowing anybody, no family, no connections, we formed our own family with the friends that we made. You know, my mum had her best friends, and I hung out with their kids, and we had our own little gang in the caravan park that would hang around the rec block and hang outside the, you know, soft drink machine and play games and muck around. And so, you know, it wasn't all bad. There was lots of fun there, and of course I had a freedom that I hadn't had before. This bad period of my life was essentially over. Yeah, so we stayed there for a while, and then we moved into a flat for about another year. And after that, being the very, you know, sensible little boy that I was, I decided this life of having, you know, drug dealers and drug addicts and all kinds of colourful characters out in my life was, you know, too much for a little boy to handle, to take. You shouldn't have to have all that. So I basically told Mum, I said, we have to move back to Tasmania. We need to be with our real family, like Mum's family, and kind of start a new life, just the two of us. She's a very good and committed single mum, you know, and to all the single mums out there, I salute you, because it's a hard gig, especially if you've got a kid with problems or baggage like that. And how she kind of navigated what, you know, she was as much a victim as I was in a lot of ways. Kudos to her. But, yeah, sensible little me went, well, let's move back to Tassie, and that's what we did at the start of 1988. And that's essentially where my, I guess, the next chapter in my life starts, and that's the period where I have chosen to focus on specifically for kind of an ongoing visual art project, which I've been exhibiting in various forms for probably almost 15 years now, and it's called My Pop Life. It's basically a recreation of my bedroom from when I was kind of coming of age, turning 13. So we moved back to Hobart and moved into a little two-bedroom flat out in West Moona. And, you know, the nature of rentals, you get what you're given. And my bedroom happened to be bright pink.
I can relate to that. I had a pink bedroom when I was a kid.
Oh, really? Yeah. You know, it certainly wasn't by choice, you know. On reflection, it's like, great, you know. Yes. And I'm recreating that pink bedroom in my art project now with pride. But at the time, it was kind of like very confronting. Same. Because I was really coming to terms with my sexuality. I think I'd really kind of probably accepted the fact, or, you know, come to realise that I was same-sex attracted, probably at that tail end of my time in Melbourne. Starting puberty, you start getting feelings, and, you know, it wasn't really in my control, that it was kind of like, well, this is where things are at, you know. And for, I guess, a bit of historical perspective, it wasn't really a great time to be coming to that realisation, because there were some really terrifying campaigns on the TV, you know, the Grim Reaper campaign specifically, I think traumatised a lot of kids, queer or otherwise, you know, those terrifying advertisements. Mm. But the first thing that's spoken in that advertisement is that it kills gay men, basically. And I was like, well, I think this is what I'm going to be when I grow up. Mm. And is this what's going to happen to me? So there was certainly a lot of fear associated with coming to terms with my own sexuality and my attraction.
And you were living in Tasmania, where it was still illegal at that time.
Yes. So, yeah, which, you know, really kind of, and that's, again, very much why I've chosen that era in my kind of story town. It's really a storytelling project, which is told in various ways, through words, through, you know, the actual physical recreation of my bedroom, you know, a celebration of the queer icons. You know, the queers were ruling the charts, and they were the art directors and the photographers and the fashion designers, and there was a lot to get really into, you know, as a young queer kid in that era. So you had this incredible kind of contrast between, I guess, the scary messages you were consuming and being exposed to in the media, and then all of this fabulous stuff going on in popular culture. So I was kind of somewhere hovering between the two, but 1988 being a particularly important year in terms of the gay law reform movement in Tasmania with the arrests at Salamanca. So I was 13. I was too young to be politically engaged, didn't really have much idea of what was going on in the world apart from kind of scary AIDS and I guess what I saw on the news. And I do remember those arrests on the telly. You know, we didn't have the newspaper at home, but we certainly watched the 6 o'clock news on Taz TV, and it was big news for a few months. I guess that was my first kind of consciousness raising. That was where I became more aware of that there was something not necessarily good, but there was kind of a fight back, which was very relatable for me as a young kid who had kind of stood up for myself and stopped something that was happening to me that I believed and knew was wrong. But again, still young and still really just escaping deep into that colourful world of popular culture. And, you know, the move back to Tassie was really, really hard. Melbourne was much more, dare say, progressive or just more diverse because of the population of being in such a big city. And I was a kid that constantly jumping on trains and trams and exploring the city. My best friend was like a hardcore train spotter, so we were constantly on public transport. And this is when, you know, the trains in Melbourne, they still had like the old trains that you could open the doors and windows and hang out side arms and legs, and lucky if you didn't lose a limb in the process, but it was all very exciting. And coming back to Hobart was a bit of a shock. I still kind of maybe question whether it was the right thing to do, because it was just, I think, particularly stepping back into that atmosphere of hate that particularly existed in response to the gay law reform movement really upping its profile, getting lots of new news coverage and all the kind of the hateful response that was happening to that. Luckily, I didn't read the newspaper as a 13-year-old. I was too busy reading smash hits. So I wasn't really getting all of the hateful stuff, but I've done a lot of research since for my project, and reading those letters to the editor in particular, some nasty stuff in there, you know, and obviously a lot of it's coming from a kind of Christian right viewpoint, which I can kind of like understand, because that's often, unfortunately, what some Christians are taught in their respective churches, is that this is wrong, we're all going to go to hell. So, yeah, I wasn't really so much exposed to that. It was more the AIDS crisis that was the thing, I guess, that was everywhere for years, you know, for many, many years. It was the number one scary thing. I think the first time I realised that queerness was, I guess, looked down upon was, so the first term that I ever heard, well, poofter was a big word that was, you know, spoken as just a general insult to anyone, you know. So I guess that one didn't maybe bother me as much. But I remember hearing gay people being described as pansies, and that was really confusing because I loved pansies, like the flowers. I thought they were beautiful, you know. I'm like, but pansies are nice. Like, why are you talking about them in such a horrible way? So it was kind of more confusing than anything, but it did make me aware, and that was probably like when I was 10. Yeah, so there was that. I think, you know, Rock Hudson dying in 1985 was such a big news story. I think that's probably around the same time. It was probably in relation to him dying of HIV/AIDS. It was probably a member of my family going, oh, I can't believe he was a pansy, you know. So it was, it wasn't explicit, but it was definitely
derogatory kind of.
Yeah, derogatory. It gave me the idea that, oh, right, there's people that don't like that. I don't know why. And I wasn't identifying as that. I think there was something in me that obviously I thought about it. I thought quite deeply about it. I didn't understand because probably, you know, that was emerging, that awareness. But really, you know, it took me another couple of years to, I guess, really go, well, yes, I am that. I think it all gets a little bit clouded as well if you're an abuse survivor because, you know, certainly as I got older, I questioned whether I was gay because I had been abused by a male. Did that make me gay? Is that, you know, and that's, again, a complex way of framing it because you could actually hate being gay because you feel like the only reason you are gay is because of what this very bad thing that happened to you. So that just throws another kind of spanner in the works. You're like, how do I feel about that? But yeah, I think, yeah, family didn't really talk about it, you know. It was really more, I guess, school, the school culture. I was never really targeted for being different at school. I think I looked different. I maybe acted a little bit different. I think a lot of kids thought I was cool because I came from Melbourne. I'd come from Melbourne, you know, and I had my like Footscray Market cheap fake Converse All-Stars that I was dreaming of getting the real thing one day, but like nobody was wearing those in Hobart. Like, so I was ahead of the fashion game. So I think I was a little bit exotic when I started school, and this is at Cosgrove High School. So, you know, I was told before I even went to Cosgrove that this is a really scary school. Like, this is really rough. My dream was to go to Rose Bay High, you know. It had always been my dream, even back in primary school, because, you know, my kind of best friend who lived over the fence, he had great parents that doted on him and he was spoiled, and they took him to America and to Disneyland, and he was going to go to Rose Bay High, and I was like, oh, Rose Bay just sounds so nice, you know. And, you know, I ended up at Cosgrove, which was actually all right. It wasn't the worst school to be at. I had some really good teachers, you know. I really liked my what do they call your homeroom teacher. Had a really good art teacher. I guess to go back a little bit again, why I was, I guess, fairly confident and self-assured as a kid, even with the stuff I was going through, was I was really good at art, and I was told by a lot of people around me that I had a special talent. It wasn't something that I chose. I'd been drawing for as long as I could remember. You know, my first memory of drawing was back when we were still living in Geeston, and my parents owned a white and orange vinyl lounge suite, and the back of the couch was just this big white canvas. So I would go in and hide. I'd love it if like somebody like found this in the tip shop or something. I was like, oh, I found this great couch. It's got all these drawings all over the back of it. So I would hide in and draw these pictures on the back of this couch. Anyway, I'm going off a track a little bit there. But that was something that I was, yeah, very confident in my ability in, you know, partly coming from myself. It was just an instinctual, natural thing. And I guess then I got enough positive kind of response and feedback to that from either teachers or even my family. So I said, oh, you're going to be an artist one day, you know. And my dream from basically grade six onwards was to study at the Victorian College of the Art, probably like a little bit inspired by the TV series Fame, where it's like all these creative people going to school and just expressing themselves, and that really kind of appealed to me. Yeah, so school was all right, but, you know, I was still grappling with all of my stuff, all of my issues. I was also very insecure. I think the art stuff was the only thing that really I guess I was holding on to, you know. I was escaping into pop culture, so that was kind of hiding away from the world and just indulging in all the colour and the queerness and of what was basically in the charts, watching Rage religiously, staying up all night, watching it all night long, setting up the mattress in front of the TV, just give me more, and, you know, sometimes at like between 4 and 6 a.m. before the Top 50 started, they'd play all this kind of really interesting music, like the stuff that was popular in, you know, in the UK, like house music or you know, kind of queer music. So there must have been somebody there working for the ABC who was programming this stuff in for like little kid like me to kind of go, oh, wow, this is this is who I am. This is what I love. This is what I want to do. Yeah, so I guess life was kind of, yeah, again, a balance between kind of immersing myself into that and becoming completely pop culture obsessed, which is not just a queer kid thing. It's an all teenage kid thing. Yeah, so there was that, but, yeah, I was kind of dysfunctional, I guess, in my everyday life. I had a very, very close relationship with my mum. We're still like two peas in a pod. We support each other through all of our life's challenges. And, yeah, but our relationship, I guess, became particularly intense at that point, so which was a good thing. I think she was probably struggling with being back in Tassie. Yes, it was nice to reconnect with family, but really that was kind of, you know, Mother's Day, Christmas Day, definitely every year, and then occasional visits down the Hill Valley. But really it wasn't like our family was there with us all the time, and we certainly didn't have that sense of family that we had in Melbourne, where we were like everybody's lives were overlapping. We're all, it was like one big tribe. We had the Maoris, and we had the, you know, the druggies, and that, and the these people, and the that people, and the, everybody just kind of shared their lives. It was messy, but it was close,
yeah,
really close. And I don't think I appreciated that when I basically made the decision and told Mum, we've got to move back to Tassie. We need a more stable life. So yeah, we've got a more stable life, but it was almost definitely a more boring life. Living in a little quiet Tassie, you know, quiet northern suburbs of Hobart. No shade, like love Hobart. But for me, I think, yeah, it was quite challenging being in such a small place again. And so I just remember that period, apart from all the music in my head, you know, all the 7-inch records I played and my cassettes, it was a really quiet time. That's how I kind of look back on everything apart from my pop culture obsession, was it's just really quiet. We just kept on living. I kept on, you know, struggling. I started becoming very non-compliant, I guess you could nicely put, in terms of my school attendance. So this is in grade 8, so first year back. Cosgrove had this weird 6-day timetable, yeah. So you never had the same classes on the same day. So I would feign illness every day except the day that I had art class, and I got away with it only for as long as I did. Like, I'm not sure how many months it was, but it was definitely months, by these changing days. So Monday would be art class, next week it would be Tuesday, the following week it would be Wednesday. So I kind of played into that and took advantage of that because I just didn't want to be at school. I think I just found, oh, you know, I guess looking back, there would have been, you know, emerging toxic masculinity. There were definitely some really rough kids that you didn't want to mess with, even though I didn't get kind of targeted directly. It was there. It was a bit scary. I was still kind of, you know, I was a bit cocky and confident because I still felt like I was like the trendiest kid in school with my, you know, Kmart ensemble. But, you know, I knew the right things to mix and match. And it was also that period in 1988, I officially became a teenage hair model. So this was a great source of self-confidence for me. So we had a little hair salon down the road just off Springfoot Avenue, classic hair design, not there anymore, but I believe there is still a hairdresser in that shop. And yeah, went to get a haircut one day and met Chris the hairdresser. Kind of, I thought he was, you know, straight out of Melbourne, trendy, had his hair gelled just the right way, had the right jeans, had his, you know, had the right shoes with the white socks, rolled up jeans, always a nice crisp shirt. I was like, oh, finally someone like cool. And he invited me off the bat. Like, I'd always been told as a kid that I had amazing hair. Every grandmother would be just like coming up to me and stroking my, oh, you got such beautiful hair. I was a redhead, so, you know, I got picked on for that. But then I had the other side, which was, oh, your hair, you know, and it's not red, it's auburn. So, you know, I prided myself on having auburn hair, never red hair. You know, it was not like red, it was slightly toned down. And then being told by a hair professional that I had fabulous hair and would you like to be my model? And I was like, yes, please. So that started another really positive point in my life where I really gained a lot of confidence, and that's probably when I started attending school full time. I think by that point it had become apparent to somebody at the school that I was playing this timetable for all I could, or they'd, you know, obviously noticed that I hadn't been attending very much over a period of time. So that got dealt with and I'm like, yep, back to school. I'm going to have to go back to school. But that kind of coincided with this new exciting journey I was on as a hair model. And, yeah, that continued on for quite a few years. So that was a really good thing as well. So I like to reflect on the positive stuff. It's obviously very difficult to process still some of the difficult things that happened earlier in my life. But at the same time, I think just kind of becoming aware of my queerness would have been just a difficult journey in itself. So the fact that I had this kind of outlet, one through popular culture, which just the obsession just grew and grew and grew as my record collection grew and my tape collection grew, and you know, I upgraded from a mono record player to a stereo record player and got a double cassette recorder so I could like record off the radio and like do mixes and things and try to be like, you know, a little DJ in my bedroom. So I kind of looked back now and it's really all of that stuff that I obviously prefer to reflect on, but they're actually the lasting memories in a lot of ways because they really helped me through a difficult time. So by year 9 and 10, I'd gotten my confidence back. I was doing well at school, making friends, becoming, I think, like some queer kids do, not the class clown as such, but, you know, I always had witty one-liners, which would have the girls just almost peeing themselves. So I kind of became that kid, which was great. I had the confidence. I had the friends. There was still no question that I would ever, like, come out or any of that stuff. Queerness was still very much like, do not tell a soul, do not tell your mother, do not tell anybody. And I don't know if there were services back in the day like what you offer and other great, amazing services that are here for queer kids now. There may well have been, but they did not reach me. But I dare say there was a lot less support than there is now. So that wasn't an option I even would have considered. So I kept that to myself, but, you know, still maintained a public level of fabulosity, but just put it down to being trendy, because trendy was everything back in those days. And, kind of got through the rest of high school. Got my first girlfriend in grade 10. She was great. I was convinced I was head over heels in love. I'm a very romantic person, so to me, just having somebody to just be all kind of, I guess, infatuated with and feel all those nice, warm, mushy, lovey-dovey feelings was enough for me, you know. It did come to the crunch later when, you know, we are to 15, 16-year-olds. There's going to be an expectation of some kind of physical connection beyond pash behind the shed. So, you know, that was the end of that relationship. But, you know, wonderful, wonderful relationship for, I think, the 6 months that it lasted, and still friends on Facebook. And, you know, I'd really like to catch up one day and just have a talk about all that. Say, sorry I kind of strung you along there, but you did really mean something to me. But that was an interesting kind of little moment of being – so we were kind of the most prominent couple on campus, and she just happened to have been going out with one of the bad boys before me. So that was actually when the bullying began, was in grade 10, us together, you know, getting rocks thrown at us during the lunch break. But at that point, I was like so in love. I did not care. Like those rocks weren't hitting me. They were just ricocheting off me. Sure, it hurt and it was kind of like, what's your problem? But, you know, love is such a powerful thing. Even that kind of naive young love, it was still real at the time. And, but that was another really great thing to happen to me, even to just to have that visibility of suddenly, oh, everyone's looking at us like we're like a celebrity couple at Cosgrove High School. Like, wow, loving that. And that was basically, yeah, that was high school.
So what happened after school? Where did you go? Did you stay at home for a while?
Yeah, stayed at home. Tassie has that unusual system where school ends at year 10 and you have to make a decision whether you're going to call it a day in terms of formal education, or are you going to take the next step to college, which really was a step, like a baby step to university. I always knew I wanted to go to university from as long as I could remember, certainly from aspiring to go to the Victorian College of the Arts as a 10-year-old. And the first person in all of my family, both sides of the family, extended family, first one to do it and wanting to do it. Wow. Almost for that reason, got to be the first one. Not because I wanted to prove something. It's just I just knew that's where I needed to go, you know, just like I knew I needed to be in the big smoke when I saw that Kevin Corby sign flashing, you know, on Davies Street. It's just something quite instinctual. So I decided to go to Elizabeth College. That's where most of my friends, like I'd made kind of almost a new bunch of friends kind of in most like around year 10, around the time I had my girlfriend, and we had a really good kind of gang at school. We would hang out outside the PE office and we weren't like the cool kids. And the cool kids are actually pretty lame on reflection. You know, they were the bitchy, nasty ones and you thought they were better than everybody else. We were kind of like, I don't know, the untouchables. We had the coolest parties. We had the friends with the big sisters who could get all the booze for us and stuff. That wonderful your grade 10 experience of, you know, like 16th birthday party after 16th birthday party, you know, all turning sweet 16, which then kind of flowed into year 11. I turned 16 in, you know, year 11. And, but as problematic as I think sometimes that system of having to basically stop your education and then restart it at a new place, as daunting as that might be, especially for like a poor kid or kid that doesn't, you know, they may aspire to some further education. They may not want to go to university, but, you know, I think finishing year 12 is a huge difference to finishing year 10. And nothing wrong with just deciding year 10's it for me as well. I want to move into a vocation or whatever you want to do. But, you know, certainly for me, I knew this was just a stepping stone to the next thing. So college was fantastic for me and all of my friends as well. It was kind of like baby university. We had the freedom. You could wag all you want. No one's going to really hold you accountable, which, of course, I did. And as many of us did, ended up doing 3 years at college, which you could do, which was great. You could do it in your own time. So, yeah, I wasn't the most committed student for the first couple of years, but I studied art and loved that and just loved the environment, loved being so close to the city centre, like, again, just gravitating towards bigger things, busier places, more people, hanging out in the Coles cafeteria, just thinking, oh, I'm so sophisticated, having a banana sundae with my friends in a diner, you know. It was great. It was really great. Unfortunately, my relationship with my girlfriend ended kind of around probably my 16th birthday, and it was like, clearly we're not going to have like a physical relationship. I think I was probably starting to feel guilty by that stage, and obviously by that point I was very aware of who I was, what my, you know, sexual kind of preference was. Still nowhere near actually exploring it, but aware of it, and had seen enough culture, popular culture, and learning more at college, particularly about art and discovering queer artists like Warhol, like Robert Mapplethorpe was a big one for me. So kind of getting a sense of confidence and self in that, but still very privately, still not out to my friends, family, anybody. Yeah. But, you know, I got through my 3 years of college and, you know, mostly had a really good experience. By the third year, I was old enough to go to nightclubs, which was just like heaven to me because that was what I'd been dreaming of since I was 13. So when I turned 18, or actually started, you know, clubbing from 16, but then legally going every weekend from 18, met a really good friend who she's a party girl, so we're just going out every weekend, you know, drinking way too much, but I guess using that as a way of getting the courage to get on the dance floor and then finding my groove on the dance floors of Hobart, the Cadillac Club specifically. But, you know, there were some other great clubs. There was like The Lodge, which was kind of like a club that everybody went to. It was seemed to me, even though I was still quite young and naive, seemed to be kind of, you know, you could be gay, you could be straight. You know, I remember there was like one night I'm there and there was like no one on the dance floor except this pissed guy playing air guitar to like house music and just going, I love this place. it was my introduction to like diversity, to go, oh, right, there is something about the power of this music or this kind of atmosphere. And that was that specific place, because the Cadillac Club had all kinds of problems, you know, particularly the person who ran it. But the Lodge was kind of like anything goes. It was cool. It had velvet curtains and a, you know, and a mirror ball and a like a deer head on the wall. And, you know, I didn't even go there really to drink. I just went there to dance. And, you know, me and my kind of more alternative friends, because I started becoming like a semi-goth. By that stage, you know, I was exploring the subcultures, because that was the year really when subcultures were really kind of becoming almost like a mainstream thing, you know, as a kid. If you weren't like normal or mainstream, then you would go, well, which other path am I going to choose? Because I don't fit into that box. So maybe I'm a goth, or maybe I'm, you know, something else. Maybe I'm queer, but I wasn't kind of self-assured enough at that point to kind of own that and wear it and show it. So just being different was kind of enough. And I never felt that I needed to conform to one particular style. I was just kind of feeling it out and going, oh, yeah, you know. And I discovered The Cure and it's just like, wow, this is amazing, and Kate Bush. And I think all of that stuff was actually really useful, because that was at the point around 17 where I really started to process what had happened to me in my earlier childhood. So that was when I went through my dark phase, you know, started to become depressed, started to self-harm. Not necessarily that it was any worse than maybe what I'd gone through in the years leading up to that point, but I guess I found an outlet. It wasn't necessarily the best or the healthiest way to be expressing myself or to be treating my body. Or thinking about myself, but certainly getting into that darker music and the lyrics, you know, getting into poetry and, you know, being really obsessed with The Cure, going to Melbourne with my goth friends to see them play in Melbourne, just such an exciting thing in itself, like a pilgrimage. Didn't really last that long, but I still love their music. Like, it's never left me. I like all styles of music. But definitely pop was my preference, and dance music. Dance music really probably number one at that point, because I could go out and dance to it. Completely different when you can actually dance to it with a DJ and you're the guy that dances until the club shuts. You're the only guy left on the dance floor at the end of the night, and the DJ's like, you're cool because you're dancing to my music, and like, I know I am. So, you know, getting this confidence and, yeah, I actually exhibited a body of work years and years ago, and it was called Disco Saved My Life, and that kind of encapsulates that, how the dance floor really allowed me to be myself, allowed me to express myself, even though I wasn't kind of overtly queer at the, you know, the time. I still hadn't come out. I didn't come out until I was in my early 20s. So that was still, you know, years down the track. But, yeah, came out of that, went straight into uni, loved learning. At that point I've got two voices in my head. I've got the one going, well, you're never going to get a job being an artist, you know, and that was probably the one that I was hearing the most from people around me as well, not necessarily in a discouraging way, but it's kind of like jobs were everything, jobs define us, you know, and I still don't think that a job defines you unless you, I guess, choose for it to define you, but it shouldn't have to. Yeah, and that was when I made the fateful decision to ditch art and go down the, you know, humanities route, which no regrets, because I really needed to learn more about the world at that point. I wanted to become more politically engaged. There was still that growing political awareness that had kind of started with the gay law reform movement in 1988. And obviously that story did not end in 1988. That was still going right until after I finished university, until the law was finally changed. So that was all still going on at the time, you know, and I was aware of that. I was still too in the closet to kind of engage with that and to become politically active in that way. But, you know, I went to other protests, government funding cuts to teachers and, you know, so I think going and studying humanities was a good thing. I think if I'd gone straight into art school, I may have had a little bit of a blinkered view of the world. Yeah, but, yeah, got through uni, first share house, first year of uni, and then got my own flat in second year of uni, which then I kept through. So I was living 5 minutes down the road from the uni, fully independent. By that point, my mum had moved up to Queensland to make up for some lost time with my sister, who'd lived up there ever since 1981. And she was starting a family. And so I think mum made the good move to go up there and spend some quality time with her. But, you know, I love the independence. That was really great. Still not really coming to terms with my sexuality, but had started going to Lacage very occasionally with, my party friend. And so that was kind of the closest I got to, I guess, almost my queerness slipping out. One particular night I went there and we just liked the music. They just played the best music. There was a pair of painted lips on the wall with the smoke machine would blow out the lips. It's like, that's cool. And, but, you know, it was the first time I got hit on by a guy and it was kind of amazing. He was gorgeous, gorgeous, tall Vietnamese guy. And I don't know if this was a true story. It seemed very true and believable at the time, but he was being sent home to Vietnam to do military service, and this was his last night out partying in Hobart before he had to go and do this horrible thing that he was dreading. And would I be the one to spend that final night with him? You know, it could have been a line, I don't know, but I'm just like, well, he was stunning. He was like a model. I was totally feeling my oats with him, thinking I was attractive, you know. And I think that was the first time I realised, oh, right, I'm kind of maybe attractive to other guys. So there's something going on here. At that point, you know, I wasn't out to my friend. We were at this club. I was like, no, I can't do this, can't do this. Stepped back, didn't do anything, you know. And, that was kind of my first, I guess, gay experience in that respect. At that point, I moved back up to Queensland for a while. So I moved back with my mum. And, I guess that was kind of the start of my adult life, still coming to terms with sexuality. And it wasn't really until moving to Melbourne, you know, a few years later, where I was completely not alone. I moved down and moved in with some friends originally from Hobart and moved into a share house, but I didn't have any family around me for the first time. And still couldn't come out. Still too hard. Still kind of carrying, I guess, the baggage, the shame, you know, of not just being queer but also being a survivor of abuse, just not knowing how my sexuality would go with another person because of that, and because of, you know, I was convinced that I couldn't really trust anybody in my life, like friends, family, lovers, anybody. You know, trust was a kind of a big
ongoing issue. So it wasn't really until the early 2000s that I actually, met someone, and that person is still my partner. I was kind of like, I just want to meet the right person the first time, and I don't want to have to play the field. I don't want to have to, I'd been out dancing for years and being hit on, and I didn't really feel safe being objectified. I didn't go out dancing to pick up. I went out dancing to dance, to express myself, to move my body. And, by that point, I would only drink to give myself that Dutch courage to get on the dance floor, and over the course of 5, 6, 7 hours on the dance floor, I'd be, stone cold sober by the end of it. And, but at least I was kind of out there. I was going to queer clubs in Melbourne and, some fabulous nights that are now considered, legendary, like Freakazoid at the Chevron. It was just enough for me to be a part of it, a part of that scene, even if I wasn't kind of meeting anybody. Most of the time I'd just go out on my own, which looking back, I'm like, that took some courage. Yeah. No, it was hard at the time. I'd be like, should I go? But I'd go anyway because the pull was so strong to the music and the atmosphere and the diversity and the love in the room and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, but, it was really I don't think I was ever going to come out until I had a boyfriend. Yeah. So my coming out would be, hi, everybody, meet Dale. And that's who it was. And, that's when I came out, and that's when it was just like, well, this is who I am. And it was almost not like I'm gay, but I'm with Dale now. Yeah. And that just made it a lot easier for me to be able to do that. And I'd certainly had so many opportunities to come out in the past. I'd had a friend that was like a best friend when I was living in Mackay in Queensland. He was just there for me anytime I wanted to just say, yep, let's do it. And I just couldn't do it. Like, there was just that thing holding me back for so long. And I knew I just wanted to have a meaningful, trusting relationship. I think, particularly because of what I'd been through. And, 22 years later, we're still in that wonderful, trusting relationship. Yeah, not that it's been easy, It's been hard for me in particular, I think, around, accepting myself as a sexual being, being open with my sexuality, and the trust issue. So, I've had a lot of, mental health challenges over the years. The relationship is such a hotbed for pushing your buttons and triggers and all of those kind of things. When things get a bit too intense, it's just, this is too much, I can't cope, whatever, you unravel or you spiral downwards, you get depressed, you get anxious. And so that was really, I think in a lot of ways, the hard journey really began after forming a relationship, but I knew from the start, I knew the moment he walked into that nightclub, I knew that was the guy I'm going home with tonight, which was a new thought. I never looked at anyone and went, I wasn't, like I said, I wasn't into picking up or didn't really want to be objectified. I wanted to be appreciated more for my fashion sense and my dance ability than my body or my looks. And, wonderful 22 years of learning and growing together, and I think our relationship is stronger now than it's ever been. And now I think I'm at a point where I really am ready to tell my story, hence being here today, but also through my art practice as well, just really putting it out there. Not just that, well, obviously I'm already out. I don't need to come out again. But, a lot of people very close to me don't know that I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. That's a really hard thing to, it's not a coming out. It's a, harder, I think, in a lot of ways. It's, there's a lot of shame around that. There's a lot of stigma around that. And there's a lot of, misunderstanding and confusion, rightly so. Who wants to understand that shit? That's bad shit. I don't want to tell everybody what happened to me, really. Maybe they don't need to know. I think I've spent years kind of grappling with that. Will I or won't I? Am I actually not being a good friend by not telling people this core thing about myself? Because it is part of who I am. I am a survivor, you know, and it took me a long year, a lot of years to get from calling myself a victim to becoming a survivor. And that's probably largely thanks to the Me Too movement, the sharing of stories like mine, hearing them. You know, Grace Tame was a huge moment for me. That was the moment where, you know, I was actually in hospital. I had a really kind of quite intense kind of cancer journey the last few years, and I really had to kind of look at myself and go, well, yeah, what am I still afraid of that I need to overcome, because these things are still holding me back. Even though I think I've got a good life, I have found success in fields that I'm interested in, but I'm definitely not where I think I should be, and I think there is that kind of keeping a secret or holding back or not being completely honest with yourself, that it's the thing that stops you getting to that next level that you aspire to. That's essentially why I'm working on, you know, while developing this project. Like I said, I've been exhibiting it in various forms for 15 years. Initially it was all about the pop culture and not really about the queer storyline or the survivor storyline. I was, you know, definitely not ready to be telling that story, but I knew I was holding back at the same time. So I think I'm at a point now where I've kind of looked death in the face like a couple of times. I've, you know, I'm a cancer survivor as well. So I'm kind of like a double survivor now. So I'm like, well, if I'm not going to take that on and become like a superhero, then what else am I going to do, you know? Yes, I'm really excited to tell my story fully in a range of ways, visually, through writing, through the very detailed recreation of my bedroom and what that pink wall actually kind of represented to me, because I knew it was kind of like the walls were going, we know who you are, and I was going, no, you don't, no, you don't. And putting it out there, and I think I'm at a point in my life now, I'm 48, I'm, you know, too old to be kind of carrying some of the shame that I have carried for probably far too long. And I'm also at a point where I'm feeling that inclination, compulsion to teach the children, to pass my story on to the kids of today. Not that it may not be heard by that many, I really don't know, but I think I'm putting it in a good place, in a really good gallery in Melbourne, which has a very, very strong history of social justice as the core foundation of the artwork, the exhibitions that they show. So it will, I know, attract an audience of the people that I want to see my exhibition. And it's not just queer kids, it's any kids, it's anyone of any age. It is a universal story. We all had to go through the awkwardness of puberty and becoming young adults and awkwardly growing to fully formed adults, and what are we going to do with our lives now, and who am I and what am I, and all of the questions that come out of that difficult growth period. Maybe not difficult for everybody, but for a lot of us, I think. And tell that story in a way that I'm really hoping will kind of touch people's hearts and teach them a bit of gay history as well, because I think that's really important. I think so much of our pride comes from knowing our history. Mm. For me, I learnt about the civil rights movement in America before I learnt about the queer rights movement, but there was something very powerful about that as a teenager that I just went, oh, right, this is amazing. This is, you know, all of this adversity and discrimination and people fighting back, and we're here, and then learning about the queer fight for justice as I got older and never really participating in it. And sometimes letting it kind of take me a few steps backwards, like the marriage equality survey. I had a nervous breakdown. I lost my shit completely. I just could not cope with, again, like 1988, but now as a fully grown man, being the subject of public debate and conversation about whether we deserve to exist, not just if we deserve to get married. It was something much deeper and It just seems surreal looking back on it, even in Hobart. I remember seeing the billboards with basically hate speech. There's people paying to put that out in the public realm in such a public visible way. Just like how wrong on so many levels, particularly for young kids. Like how would have I felt seeing that? But to do something so hateful in such a public way is just appalling, and it just tapped into every fear and bit of shame that I'd felt my whole life, not just as a queer kid but as a survivor of abuse, because to me all of that stuff is just all intrinsically linked, because that's the fabric of who I am. And it's a part of me. It doesn't define me now. Like I probably let it for too long. So I think by sharing my story, I just hope that people will see it, that they'll relate to it. It's not all doom and gloom and darkness. Like you will step into my bedroom and get like the biggest nostalgia hit of your life. Like you may not like the same pop stars that I was into, but if you're queer, you probably did. You know, there's a lot of Madonna. There's a lot of Kylie. There's the classics, you know.
Where can people keep up and follow the exhibition and the work that you're doing?
Well, I'm not I do have a social media account. I'm not going to say it yet because I haven't decided on the final name. The project is called My Pop Life. It will be exhibited in Melbourne at the Cunahan Gallery in Brunswick from August to October this year. So I'll be working hard on that for the next few months. Very excited to put some new work out there. It will be very it'll be pop, but it'll be political as well. So there'll be a bedroom installation, which will be basically a time capsule. I'll be recreating my room in as much detail as possible, working completely from memory. Don't have photos of my room, like what kid photographed their bedroom back in those days, whereas now every kid's broadcasting from their bedroom. I'm really interested in how that youth culture has changed with the changing technology, the emergence of social media. Now you've got things like AI, you've got all these things and the access to culture that kids have now. I can't even imagine what it would be like to be a young queer kid having all this at your fingertips, like good and bad, you know, porn, maybe not so good, but not all bad. We found Robert Mapplethorpe was my porn, you know, when I was a teenager. Like that was all I could get my hands on. It was often art and you know, that kind of sexy art that you might be lucky enough to find in a textbook or something. And, I'm really interested in kind of making the comparison, or not necessarily a comparison, but looking at both and going, well, yeah, a lot of things have changed for the better. Some things I don't think have changed for the better. You know, I think the world has become more complex and more confusing than it was back then. It's easy to kind of look back on those days with rose-tinted glasses and go, the world was simpler then. But, no, there was a lot of bad stuff going on then. And personally, I feel very grateful that I was part of the generation that was affected by HIV/AIDS, but I feel very lucky that that did not affect me directly. Maybe my being a bit of a sexual prude for so long and being resistant, I think obviously that fear was partly related to the fact that I, as a 13-year-old, I thought my future as a gay man was to grow up and die of AIDS and be hated by a whole bunch of people. Not a very good kind of start of your emerging adulthood. But thankfully the pop culture interjected and went, hey, look at me, you can be fabulous. And, you know, the unspoken queer language that pop culture I think still speaks with certain artists, or there's still a lot of queer people that are involved in the creative part component of pop culture. And I think there's that kind of, if you know, you know, kind of coded language. And I think it's a deliberate thing. I definitely think that artists, you know, pop stars or creatives working in that area or in visual arts as well, were consciously doing that. There was just something about the way they expressed themselves that straight people go, oh, aren't they colourful and fun? But we were like, no, they're everything. They are everything, and I want to be that, you know, when I grow up. It's just, there's a power to that, and I think that's something that kids should
just continue to tap into, you know, escape into that world if it helps you to become who you want to be. And amazing things now like RuPaul's Drag Race, where sure, it's got all that colour and the camp, the campery of queer culture and all of that stuff, which is great for kids to be seeing that. But for me, it's all about the confessionals. It's about the stories that those queer people tell, and still makes me cry every time I watch that show because it's just so relatable. And I'll definitely be making a reference to that in my exhibition by writing a letter to my younger self, as they do often at the end of a series. Yeah, so I think to my younger self, I would it's a really hard question to answer, actually. I know there's been a couple of times I've seen it on RuPaul's Drag Race where I know that that person has had a painful childhood, and you can tell because, well, generally it's painful to say. So all I can say is I love you and I will always love you, and be yourself, be happy, find love wherever it, in whatever form it comes in, as long as it's open and accepting of who you are. And yeah, don't ever give up on that, because it is, as cliche as it sounds, it's the most important thing in life. It really is. But I think I even knew that as a kid anyway, so I'd probably, my younger self would be like, yeah, I know, even though I would have no idea really, being, you know, so young and naive and a little bit quite manipulated into what love meant. But I think I knew that. I think I just, I felt that in lots of good ways growing up as well, from my mum, from other people in my life, and even kind of virtually through this unspoken language from the TV screen, you know, the way that Boy George looked at me in that video, or Madonna or whoever it was, that kind of, I see you, there was just that thing. And I think, yeah, being seen is really important. Doesn't mean you have to show it to the world, but certainly see yourself. And I think self-awareness, if I could convey to my younger self, give him a TED talk in self-awareness, what that means and how that will help you on your path in life, I think that would be probably the thing that, yeah, that I think would be the most impactful.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all of your story.
Thanks for listening.
I think it'll resonate with a lot of people, and yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for, yeah, thanks for having me.
If this episode has raised any issues for you, please take some time to reflect and ensure you reach out for support if you need it. If you are listening in Tasmania, you can contact Working It Out via their website or calling 6231 1200 during business hours. If you need immediate mental health support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224636. Both services are available 24/7. If you would like to get in touch or share your story on this podcast, please send us an email at nwpride@outlook.com. This podcast is produced by Northwest Pride, a community group based across the north, northwest and west coast of Tasmania. They host events and social inclusion opportunities for anyone who is a part of the LGBTIAQ+ community, their friends and allies. This podcast is made possible by the support of Working It Out. You can hear future episodes and all of our past episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Please follow, rate, and review if you can. It does help us to reach more folks who might enjoy or benefit from hearing these amazing life stories. We'll be back soon. Take care of yourself and each other.